Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And action!
Hello and welcome to episode 384 of the Filmmakers Podcast. This is a podcast where we talk filmmaking, from indie film to studio films and everything in between. How to get them made, how to make them, and how to try not to royally F it up, in our very, very humble opinion. I am Giles Alderson. I'm a writer, director, and a producer. And I'm delighted to welcome on the show today the director, Nikolai Arcel. Nikolai sat down to talk with myself and Dom Lenoir all about filmmaking, all about his career as a filmmaker, and his latest film, The Promised Land, which stars Mads Mikkelsen and is a stunning visual treat. Nikolai talks about why he is not proud of all of his films, what it's like adapting a book or a novel, working in Denmark, how films get financed, and the system in Denmark. He talks about how having a family changed him as a filmmaker, and how he learned directing by failing. He also gives a really interesting directing actor tip. We dive into what it's like on set, and Nikolai gives you what it's like for him on a typical day on set of one of his films. He also mentions why every day on a set is a compromise. For those of you out there who have made a film, you totally understand that concept. He dives deep into why he storyboards every shot on every film he's ever directed. He talks through some editing techniques, why you should write your own script, and dealing with goats and wolves, and why neither is any fun on set. So how are you this week? Thank you for listening. It does mean a lot. And as a little favour, do go like that plus button. We've been told that about 60% of our listeners are not subscribers. So see that little plus button and do me a favour and just click it, because it makes all the difference you would not believe behind the scenes. And that helps us get even better guests than we are getting, which I don't know how that could possibly be, but it is. Obviously, recently we've had on Matthew Vaughan. We've had on Grant Hesloff, the producer of The Boys in the Boat. We've had on J.A. Bayona, the director of Society of the Snow, as well as Sean Durkin, the director of Ironclaw, and last week, Michelle Franco, who directed Memory, and the team behind Oppenheimer. So it's not like we haven't had amazing guests so far, but imagine where we could go next. So do me a favor and just click that subscribe button. Then it comes to the top of your podcast of choice inbox every week, every Tuesday, when we release a new episode. So not only thanks for listening, but how are you getting on? Because last week, me and Dom had a little discussion about the industry at the moment and how difficult it is. And we had so many responses to it, so many people feeling the same way. And you only have to go on Twitter at the moment to see the amount of pain there is out there for filmmakers, for producers, for directors, for screenwriters, for crew members who are struggling. And like I say, just hang in there. This is what you want to do and this is what you're good at, then hang in there. If you haven't made anything yet, then totally understand, this is a very difficult time. And if you are making things, you are working your ass off to make that happen. Not just lucky, but you're working your ass off. So congratulations to you. Keep it going. Let us know how you're getting on. And for those of you who are feeling like it's just getting too much, take a breath, take a moment. If this is what you really want to do, if this is your life choice, I am a filmmaker, I am going to continue being a filmmaker, then make it work for you. Work out what you need to do to carry on being a filmmaker, whether that's doing something else for a bit, whether that's going teaching, whether that's getting a different kind of job so that you can write in the evenings or the weekends, or you can get together with your friends on the weekends and evenings, then make that happen. It's important that you don't stop believing in yourself. That's the most important thing. Take anything away from this podcast, and the thing we want to say the most to you is you can do it. 383 episodes on just that. I've done this for nearly 6 years now. You can do it. I've seen people who had made anything at all go out and do it just by being inspired. So I hope you are inspired. So take comfort in the fact that everyone is in the same boat. If you're a bit of a loose end this Thursday and you're in London, then come on down to the Ritzy in Brixton, where Matthew Butler Hart and Tori Butler Hart will be screening their film, their latest film, the brilliant dark found footage comedy horror. Less comedy, more horror. Dagger from 7 o'clock this Thursday, the 22nd. I'll be on hosting duties as well. But ignore that. You'll get so much information. Cast and crew are going to be there. So come on down this Thursday, the 22nd, February 2024, in case you're in the future. So on Friday, we're going to have a special episode with One Love director, Reynaldo Marcus Green. He sat down with Dom and had an amazing chat about making the Bob Marley movie One Love. So look forward to that on Friday. Then on Tuesday, we have the director, Issa Lopez, of, and writer, of True Detective, Night Country. Yeah, with a TV, little TV special for you next Tuesday. But for now, let's get to Nikolai Arcel, the fantastic man, brilliant director, Danish filmmaker and screenwriter, who's best known for A Royal Affair, which also starred Mads Mikkelsen, and that won 2 prizes at the Berlin International Film Festival, where some of you have probably just come back from. I couldn't go this year, but I imagine you all had an interesting time. I'm looking forward to hearing how Tobias V's got on, how Lucinda Rhodes Takra got on. But anyway, Nikolai won 2 prizes there for his film A Royal Affair. It was also nominated for Best Foreign Language Film at the Academy Awards. But he made his first film, King's Game, which won him Best Director at the Danish Film Academy Awards. And then he followed that with the adventure film Island of Lost Souls before making the comedy Truth About Men. He also wrote the screenplay for The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the original movie, fantastic Swedish movie, which he got nominated for a BAFTA award for Best Adapted Screenplay. Recently, he directed The Dark Tower, which he also wrote. The Dark Tower starred Idris Elba, Matthew McConaughey, and Jackie Earl Haley. And he directed a couple of episodes of Millennium for TV. And now he has made The Promised Land. This is a stunning piece of work, set in the 18th century in Denmark. It's an epic melodrama that combines elements of survival thrillers, westerns, period and historical dramas. It's basically a stunning and stark look at one man's quest to tame the harsh wilderness of the barren northern territory of Denmark. So, it is out in cinemas. Now, go watch it. The Promised Land. I promise you, you won't be disappointed. It is brilliant. Huge shout out to Mike Fury from the Warrior Agency for setting this up. So, let's get to it. This is myself, Jozzles, sitting down with Dom Lemoir and the amazing director, Nikolai Arcel.
To the Filmmakers Pod. He's on recording.
Thank you.
We'll start with that.
We'll start with that.
Welcome to the Filmmakers Podcast. We saw the movie and it was a really engaging, thrilling watch. It's one of those movies where it really grips you and you're really on side with the the villainy of the bad guy and Mads Mikkelsen's character's, you know, immense struggle. I mean, it sort of reminds me of Braveheart when he's struggling against the evil English lords, that kind of storyline. And it was, yeah, very well put together characters.
Thank you.
So what's the buzz like for you at the moment? Everything good?
Everything feels really good. I'm proud of the film. I'm not proud of all my films.
So it's really?
Actually quite nice to be proud of a film you're doing. I'm proud of most of them, but there's certain films that you do in a career that you go like, you know, I probably should have done a better job there. So this time I'm really proud. I think I probably, you know, there are times when you as a filmmaker kind of maybe even exceed your own talent a little bit, or what you were able to achieve. And on this one, I was on a little bit of shaky ground because some of the characters are quite you can't really put a finger to exactly what it is Mads' character is. It's not like he's a hero, nor is he a villain of any kind. So it's like he's a little bit, he's not a very nice guy.
but he's sort of heroically stubborn, isn't he?
Yes, he is, but he doesn't always make the right choices. Mm. He's not very nice to the people who he's with. Mm. He has this kind of like he's very driven and ambitious basically he's greedy. He just wants to be somebody, wants to be someone important. He wants to have money. That's not a really nice sort of quest. It was a little bit more, it was a different film than I'm used to doing, which is a little bit more black and white in terms of heroes.
I don't know if he came across as dislikable.
No.
I think the thing is because it's mess.
Because,
I mean, it definitely is. Like he's one of those actors where you're on his side.
Right.
I suppose it's like when you create such a bad guy.
Right.
The hero sort of becomes immediately likable.
Right.
But I suppose you can understand his. He seems like a guy that's like had a really hard life, and this is like his sort of quest for redemption from being in the war. That's kind of how I read into
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
And that's kind of what redeemed him for me. But yes. what is it that those conversations with Mads that you developed when you'd, you know, sort of looking at the character with him?
We were really trying to build a character who changes a lot, right, throughout the entire movie. But the idea was, what if we could avoid the sort of dramatic movie cliche of having one big thing happen to him at one point in the movie? You know, there's always that one scene where the hero realizes and looks at the sun and goes, oh my God, and then he changes. And we really wanted to make this a lot more subtle, so that when you meet him in the beginning, he's one thing, and when the film ends, he's sort of almost naturally, or without you having quite discovered it, he's a completely changed man. And I think that was the big sort of thing for me. If we can do that with that character, you know, in the beginning he doesn't care about anybody, he doesn't have love for anyone, he doesn't have emotions, you know, almost aside from the emotions that he has, that he wants redemption, that he wants to be somebody, he has emotions for himself, narcissistic things. And then in the end he's all about the people that he cares about. And it's not one thing, it's just like very slow. It's like real life in a way. It's like how you hopefully develop as a person as you get older and wiser.
I think that was what was so magical about this film, because it drew you in from the beginning, because we were fascinated about who this character was. Mads played him so well. The shots were designed so well, the way you directed it felt so fresh, alive, but also I was intrigued. It just drew you in, and the simplicity of it at times, but then also the majestic beauty of it and where you shot. But before we get to that, was Mads always your choice? Obviously you'd worked together before,
right,
Royal Affair. Mm-hmm. Was that correct?
Right.
Yes. Was that the first time you worked together?
That was the first time, yeah.
Right. And then did you have him in mind always for this?
I did. From the moment I sort of, this film is based on a novel. And the moment I read almost the first page of the novel, it says, you know, we're on the heath, a hardened sort of bitter man arrives with a steely look in his eyes. I was like, okay, that's Mess or nobody. It has to be Mess. And I almost called him like, I think 10 pages into the book and said, I think I have our next project. You know, if the book doesn't suck, you know, let's do this together. And he was like, okay, if you write a good script, you know, come back to me. And,
you were like, if I write a good script,
exactly, that's he's since Royal Affair, and obviously he's become a huge movie star. So it's not like he'll just say yes to all his friends, right? That doesn't happen.
Right. Yeah.
So I had to convince him, but it was so clearly a role for him because it really demanded such precision and so much complexity that I have to say, I'm sorry to say, and I hope this doesn't get out too much in Denmark, but nobody else than Mass has the capacity to play that part in Denmark, really.
Yeah.
He's like sort of the top of the pile in terms of just, you just never know what's going on in his mind.
Right.
And he does sort of play that very well. I also like the way you did transition the character in. Because I suppose at the start of the movie, you really think it's all going to be about him, you know, succeeding in this dream.
Right.
And that was the interesting surprise to me. And also the surprise in terms of how the story changes.
Right.
Because obviously, in the you know, the true life story of this, that there's not as much information. So there's elements you've had to fictionalize.
Right. I think there's two paragraphs in Wikipedia about this guy. There's nothing.
Yeah.
That's more than me.
Yeah. More than most of us.
Exactly. So, people have written many books on me. So
how did you flesh out what the character was going to do and how that, you know, was that transition always going to be there? Was that there in the book in terms of him choosing, I suppose, the closeness of the people he cares about versus this grand vision that it sort of leads you into at the start of the movie?
I think it was implied in the book. The book is a little more. It's a very artfully written book about nature and the heath and the sort of like this long internal monologues about, and I think Ludwig even has a captain, like Star Trek-y captain's log, you know, like you see, and then today I saw the flowers dry, you know, and we couldn't do any of that because that would just take too much time. But I think that what I related to was something very simple, was that I've become a father quite recently, nice. You know, even though I'm actually 51. Oh God.
Well, you don't look horrible. It. Yeah.
And then,
I'd put you 49.
That's
you thought I was going to say 40. Right.
Charles is 100.
Yeah, I'm way old.
I kind of saw in this character something in myself. Not that I'm like Ludwig, but I saw this, like, I've been for the past 25 years, everything I've been doing has been about my work. I've only ever wanted to be a great filmmaker and just keep getting better and better. Not so much for the, you know, accolades and all that, but really just to prove to myself that I could surpass, you know, my last film. Always like, can you make it better than the last one? And that's a drive that's fun and exciting, but it's also kind of draining in a way. It's also really, it just gives you tunnel vision in a way. So I've had sort of a tunnel vision for many years, and I thought, well, I just keep making movies until I die. That's all I need to do. That's what makes me happy. And then the moment my first son was born, I was like, oh God, I missed out on life. I have to now just focus on him. And now I have two kids, right? And so now it's become all about them. That's all I think about. I don't think about, you know, what my next step in my career is. I just think, are they happy? Are they good? Are they healthy?
Right.
So, you know, that's such a... And I thought that was what I could put into... That experience, personal, is what I could put into the character of Ludwig, who really in the beginning is like a driven, you know, all he is about is the work and he wants to, you know, prove himself and become and prove that he can do it. And then slowly he finds, oh, there's the whole concept of family and love. And, you know, it's very banal. I'm not saying it's not banal, but still that banality rings true to me now. And so I could tell the story in a non-banal way. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, you obviously did. It's so interesting how life that hits us, things that change us, changes how we are as filmmakers or people. We suddenly go, actually, that's not as important anymore.
Right.
This is what's important. I want to focus on that. Let's jump back because you started off as a bit of an editor, actually, but then into script writing, and script writing became your main, you know, drive. Sure. Obviously, you'd made a film within all that work as well, which is fascinating. And I think we'll come to that, your debut movie as a director. But as a screenwriter, do you feel it's changed from when you first started, obviously, to writing now? What's been that process like? How did you put pen to paper in the first place? What inspired you?
I think I was always writing, even when I was a kid.
Really?
You know, I was kind of this, I'm such a cliche filmmaker because I was a little bit of a lonely kid. You know, I was playing with my Star
Just
Wars
like
dolls. Right. Yeah. I was playing with my Star Wars dolls. I was doing Super 8 movies.
Yeah. We don't call them dolls. We call them
Star Wars figures.
Action figures.
No, Star Wars action figures.
My sister got me one. Exactly. She was like, no, they're dolls. You're playing with He-Man dolls. I was like, no.
And I'm sorry to say, they are dolls.
They are dolls, sadly. But, she was right.
But okay, yeah, Star Wars figures. So I was kind of like, divorced my parents, and I was a little bit, couldn't figure it out. And so my escape was really movies. I always went to the movies, and that's all I did when I was like between the ages of 8 or 9 until I, you know, was 15 or 16. That's all I really wanted to do was just to watch movies. So I started writing just because I had a sort of a talent for that, even when I was young. And I thought I was going to be a screenwriter. I didn't think I was going to be a director.
Really?
So that's why I started writing. Even when I was in film school, I was lucky enough to get into film school. My debut as a professional filmmaker was as a screenwriter. So I wrote, you know, a couple of films. Mm-hmm. And after that, I did my own first films. But then I didn't want to abandon that idea of being a screenwriter, even though I'd become a director. So what I do, which is kind of still rare, and especially in Denmark, is that I write a lot of films for other directors still. Yeah. And mm-hmm. so that's been really good for me, because writing for other directors is freeing. In a way, you don't have to, first of all, you don't have to stress about, oh, how am I going to do this scene? You can just write, and then 50 helicopters come across the, you know, it's like somebody else figure that out. You can do whatever you want. But it's also really, it's just free and creatively, because you can explore ideas that you don't necessarily think you would be really great at directing, but that you can write well, which is fun. So there are more areas like Dragon Tattoo, I don't think I could necessarily direct that. Maybe I could, but I think that the way Nils directed that was quite, and the way he cast it was perfect. But writing it was very gratifying. It was fun. And I don't think I could have written that script if I had been the director. I would have been a much more, you know, no, this has to be art and serious. But I kind of wrote a very pulpy, you know, kind of fun based on the book. And
it's kind of important to keep that separation, at least in terms of possibilities. I think one of the easiest ways to make a dull script is to try and think too much about how you're going to do it.
Oh yeah.
Because then suddenly you use all the fun bits that actually create those crazy, unique moments in the script.
And then everything is like interior apartment day.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Oh, that'll be nice. Or Hawaii.
Hawaii, Caribbean. Yeah. I love the fact that that changes. And I think that's really interesting, because I've only, the stuff that I've written, I'm focusing on directing it, or I have directed them.
Right.
So I've never actually, I have written for other people, but I've always thought, I'll be directing that. Right. So that's really interesting when someone's saying you're writing something for someone else and how that changes your mindset. I think that's really interesting. But you've also adapted so many novels as well. Obviously, this one, The Promised Land, Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. Yeah. How is that different? Obviously, you've got to adapt something that's already existing as opposed to coming up with something fresh and new.
I think it's just more fun to adapt something. Yeah, I don't know why. Original ideas for me is just such an enormous amount of choices. It's just like whenever people ask me, what would you like to do, like what's your next vision, I'm like, oh god, there are 50,000 billion ideas and I don't really know which one of them I should be doing. But then someone always hands me a book like, you should read this. I'm like, great, this is great, let's go do it.
It's
I guess you could say it's a little bit easier, but it also sharpens your directorial kind of like mind, because instead of trying to figure out what the hell is going to happen, you begin to see images, you begin to see like cast ideas and tone and ways to shoot it and ways to make the pages come alive. And so I think you know, it's like Coppola. It's not comparing myself to Coppola, but when you look at some of the great directors, a lot of them actually mainly adapt like books, right?
Well, it makes a lot of sense, because I mean, I read a lot of books when I was a kid, like fiction, yeah. And I feel like books are what forms the imagination. Like, it's what gives you the ability to create, you know, great ideas. And so when you've got your, it's like it's almost supercharging your imagination, yeah, before you start writing.
Yeah.
And I suppose it does narrow it down. Is there anything in particular that you look for in stories? That is it kind of, does it vary wildly from film to film?
It does vary quite a lot, but I mean, sometimes it's also because you get hired. I was hired to do Girl Drank Tattoo. I didn't necessarily think, oh yeah, I want to write a Swedish, you know, crime thriller about a crazy goth woman, and yeah, you know, hacker, but it was, yeah, very entertaining. I was like, okay, I'll certainly write that. Mm. And then, but the weird thing was, it wasn't a phenomenon, you know, while I was, but I was in the middle of writing the script, suddenly my mom started talking about the book. And then I was, you know, in some other country and people started talking about the book. So, oh shit, I probably should do a good job here, because everybody's reading this book.
Before that,
I was all over the beaches in Greece, you know, it's like everybody's reading that. Yeah. But I didn't realize it when I took the job. But mostly I would say I would probably look for the mix of intimacy and scope. So if there's like if there's a scope to the story, it has an epic feel or a sweeping feel, or it feels like a big theme, you know, if the theme feels grand or big and interesting and cinematic, but the characters are really strong and interesting and it has that intimate feeling. It's not like, I don't think I could ever do a straight up action film, for instance. I don't, you know, where the characters are all like, let's go shoot these guys.
The good action films, the one you actually remember and you care about, they're actually like, you know, really intimate dramas. Oh, yeah. I mean, like Terminator 2, you know, Terminator 1, like they're actually more about the characters bonding than
Terminator
they are
3.
About the action.
They are.
That's not too much.
Yeah. Terminator 3, Terminator, Dark Fate, Terminator. No, you're right.
Sponsored by Terminator.
wonderful action. Yeah, no, you're right. But, and you know, to an extent, and even Die Hard is about a guy who just needs to get back to his wife, basically, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I think probably dramatic, sort of interesting. It could be a love story. It could be something about, you know, revenge or whatever it is, but something personal that also has a backdrop of something that I find cinematic. And there's also another reason for that, which is that I really love movies and I love going to the theater to watch movies. And the times now have changed so radically that people almost never go and see a drama set in an apartment, or you do have to have something cinematic to get people's asses in the seats in the theaters right now. So it's also for that reason,
which is a shame, because I enjoy going to see a drama just as much as a blockbuster. I mean, you know, every now and then you want to go and see a blockbuster and have that huge experience, but also just sharing a really powerful drama with another bunch of people in an audience like that.
The problem times are changing, because people weren't going to see those movies.
Right.
They've moved to streaming a bit more.
Right, right.
And everyone's watching them at home.
Not
a bit. But that brings the budgets to a different level, and it's harder to get those made for us independents who are trying to go, hey, this story's great.
Right.
In terms of your writing process then, whether it's a novel or it's an original idea, do you block everything out? Do you do a scriptment? It'd be really interesting. What's the first thing? Obviously, you tackle onto theme and tone.
Theme and tone is really important. Mm-hmm. That's my first thing. Theme is really important for me. If you don't have a story to tell, and that's actually some of the one or two of the films that I've done, which I didn't really have a theme, those are the ones that don't work for me. I can't watch them today because I'm like, this is fun, but it's about nothing. So if you have a theme, and for this one, me and my co-writer, Anders Thomas Jensen, we sort of very quickly settled on the film, on the theme that was sort of control versus chaos, right?
Yeah.
The protagonist thinks he can control his life, and the antagonist says that life is chaos. And really, you could argue for either or, right? You could say, yes, you can take control of your life and your fate, But on the other hand, life always throws like crazy obstacles at you, and things happen. People die, you get sick, something else. So it's also very chaotic. So we thought that was a very universal theme that we, in any case, that was something that we all, that we kept discussing anyway.
How do you spitball that idea? Because we've talked earlier about the sort of the more surface level theme, which is obviously like, you know, the what he wants versus what he needs at the end. But how do you sort of come up with that idea for a theme? Like, what's the process to come with that?
I have to give the credit here, because, you know, I certainly saw more about sort of the father, the family man thing, the ambitious guy who becomes a family man.
Yeah, Mads' character.
But Anders Thomas, I don't know if you've seen, I would say to your listeners and to you guys, if you haven't seen his own films, like Riders of Justice, Adam Sables, he's an incredible filmmaker. So he's also a director and a writer. So, he's so strong with theme. Every single film he does has a really powerful and very sort of like clear theme. Mm-hmm. So he was the one that came up with like, this is about this and control and chaos. And like he has these big theme ideas. So that wasn't me. That was actually him.
That's interesting. Yeah. And what was it like working together with someone then? You know, which you've obviously written on your own and you've written in teams.
Yeah.
Does that differ in terms of like, do you plot it out? Do you say, right, who writes what?
We really do it together. Sort of, we do plot it out together. We sit for 1 or 2 months and put posters, you know, on post-its on the wall and like figure out the structure of it. And then it's either me or him who does the first draft. And then we change it a lot. Like, so we keep switching back and forth.
Mm. And do you rewrite each other's scenes?
We do.
Yeah, that's nice.
We do extensively. Like that, yeah. But there has to be, of course, one of us is the director. The guy who directs the current film we're doing will always be the ultimate sort of decision maker. So probably this one is more heavily rewritten by me, whereas in his films, it's him. You know, so it varies from script to script.
Yeah,
I like that. That's interesting. And do you obviously help each other when it comes to making of it then as well? If you've got these director friends?
During the editing, yes. We don't really come to set. I think, you know, we're both sort of bored. There's nothing more boring. I don't know if you know, if you feel this, but there's nothing more boring than being on somebody else's set.
When you're not doing anything. Yeah,
I actually have a really good story about that. I don't know if you can edit this and if it comes, but I, at one point in my career, I was sort of like just after Royal Affair, I was becoming sort of internationally known a little bit. And Guillermo del Toro reached out and had something that, hey, do you want to meet? And I was like, yes, I'll meet. You know, and I'm in Budapest shooting Hellboy 2. Do you want to come to set?
Yeah.
I was like, yes, I'll come to the set of Hellboy 2.
I'm free now.
I was so excited. I took the plane, you know, I landed, I stayed overnight at a hotel. I couldn't, you know, believe how lucky I was. I got to visit Guillermo del Toro on the set of Hellboy 2. I came to the set. I met him. It was great. He said, you can sit here by the monitor and look at what I'm doing. And I was like, oh my God, I'm in heaven. And like after 30 minutes, I was like, oh, when can I go? Because it's like so boring. Like waiting for the, you know, the light setups. Yeah, and yeah. Oh, I know this. This is exactly like, you know, as boring as when I'm waiting for some lights. And then after an hour, I said, Guillermo, I'll talk to you tomorrow. You know, it's like, it was such a, there's just nothing. So we don't come, Thomas and me, don't visit each other's sets for that reason, because it's not that interesting.
That's fascinating.
So where did you come up with the point in which you're going to start this movie and end it? Because that's always a difficult thing to figure out is like where to start a movie. You want to sort of start it with the ground running, but you also want to allow enough texture for like the, you know, the background of the character.
Right. Yeah. The ending was really easy because we knew. I don't know if I can spoil the ending, but there's a very specific ending that has to do with the character's development and what happens and what he needs to go do. So the ending was written in stone. The beginning was super, super tough to figure out. And I don't know that we even solved it fully. You know, there's something about, we had scenes of him being in the war. We had scenes of him like being, you know, there was a scene where others got promoted ahead of him just to show who he was. I even at one point had a draft where we had a childhood scene where he was, you know, on the manor with his, you know, he was the bastard son of this landowner. Yeah. And
but it was all
it was too much and it was too expensive. So in the end, we just went like, he gets the job. He goes out, you know.
No spoilers here.
It was like, let's just start it where it's supposed to start.
The thing is, when you've got an actor that could do that much as well, it's like you've basically just assumed in every scene, like, he can just play his history. You can just fill in the gaps emotionally.
And that's the thing, he could. That's the thing with him. You felt like, I got so much from him.
Right.
And from you pulling out whatever you did.
Right.
Because you believed in whatever his history was. He could see it through his eyes, the way he was, the way he held himself.
Right.
And that was special. So it worked.
Definitely. So, and again, that just speaks to Mads's talent. And also, not a lot of people, you know, could if I had had another actor, perhaps we would have to do some kind of emotional, like, oh, look how he was as a kid and now he... but we don't have to do that with Mads, because all the pain is in his eyes, you know, you can see it.
Yes.
Yeah, so that was good.
That is good. Well, let's talk about, we're talking about The Promised Land anyway, and the writing process. Was it something that when you knew you wanted to make this, when someone had handed you the book, you'd read it and said, right, I'm going to make this. Did you then option it? Do you send it to your producers? How does the process work for you?
Yeah.
In your career where you're at now, where you go, I want to do this next.
Right.
How do you then go about
making it? I'm fortunate enough that I, you know, in Europe or in Denmark at least, I don't think in America at all, but in Denmark, I am one of the first ones who gets an option on something new, which is, I think it's, you know, we're 5 or 6 or 7 directors who have had enough success that, you know, when somebody sends you a book, it's not like you have to fight for it. It's because they want you to do the book. And in this case, they sent the book to me and said, do you want to do this book? The publisher, right?
Right.
So of course, when I'd read it and I loved it, I said, yes, please. And we bought the rights. And
Is that your company or is it?
That's Zentropa.
Zentropa, yeah.
Right, great. Who I work for. Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Which is big really Lars von Trier's company, but he's kind of, he's not running it. He's, you know, he created it or founded it.
So I mean, now to get something green lit, it's, you know, you've obviously earned your accolades and it comes to you a little bit more easily.
Right.
How did you raise money? How did you get those first projects made when you were sort of fledgling and maybe writing, trying to get that first directing made?
Yeah, King's Game was your first directing. Yeah. Tell us about that.
That was a tough one to get made because nobody believed in the idea of a political thriller at the time. Mm. I don't know if you can even recall, you're so young, guys, but...
That's very kind of you.
But there was a time where political thrillers was like, nobody wants to go watch them. And especially in Denmark, there was a feeling that Denmark is such a safe and nice, you know, country and there's no corruption. And so people were like, nobody's going to go watch a political thriller here.
Until they made that 4-series, what was it called? Was it Borgen?
Borgen.
Yeah.
But Borgen is standing on the shoulders of our film.
Your work.
Because nobody did it. And then 2 years after our film came out, it was all the rage. Like, that's only amazing. Political thrillers got made and Borgen happened, right?
Brilliant.
And even the head writer of that show is just like, yeah, we couldn't have done it without. So I'm proud to have been part of that. So now I'm a little bored with, like, every show is a political thriller. I think it's like, okay, it's been 20 years, guys.
Been there, done that. Yeah, exactly.
I did it first.
Yeah, exactly.
But how did you raise the money?
No, it was just it was pure dumb luck. I think there's like this the big financing the way to get financing is through the government funding
and systems, right?
And there was another film that had fallen through, and the guy who sort of like gives out the money, he says like, oh, by the way, the other film has fallen through, do you want the money? And I was like, oh.
Yes, please. The guy gives out the money.
So my career really...
Different. We need that system in the UK. The guy that gives out money in the UK.
No. There was here, and that was so really like a piece of great luck that that created my career. But I would have to say, you worked hard for that. I did, and before that movie, I'd written a successful action film for kids called Catch That Kid. So that was already out. So I'd already made a little bit of a name as a screenwriter, which actually later got remade in the US with Kristen Stewart, weirdly. So I think that was also part of it. You know, they knew I could do something that was commercial. And you know,
and the fact that you'd written it, did that help as well? The King's Game?
Yes.
Was that they suddenly went, well, you've written it, it'd be easier for you to direct. And at that point, you'd made a couple of shorts anyway as a director.
Also, I'd gone to the National Danish Film School. And here's the thing about that in more so than in almost any other country, the National Danish Film School, because it's so hard to get into, 6 directors every 2 years get in. It's what? Almost like when you get in, you're already considered, yeah. Right. You're already considered to be a film, like, okay, you're one of the filmmakers that we, so it's so, it, you know, everything is luck and fortune and talent, of course, but I've been really fortunate. I've been lucky that I've seen some friends of mine who've been trying to get into to the film school who are so talented, but didn't get in. So it's really like, if you're lucky enough, then you're kind of in the system already. And mm-hmm. and from film school, there's almost like, if you've gone to film school, there's kind of a feeling that you will get money for your first feature film at some point mm-hmm. because we want to see what you can do. And that's the blessing of the government funding system, because yeah. it's all part of like trying to create a stable of artists in the film community that can grow. Right?
I suppose it's a bit like the NTFS in the UK. Like they give you money and they
right.
they try and place you.
So there is some of that here.
There's a little bit. It's, yeah, I don't think it's quite a sort of small and a right. You know, promotional club. So what did you learn on that course? Because you'd come in with a sort of screenwriting background. How did you really figure out the acting and the camera side? Was that just naturally from the story and what's on the page, or did you really have to dive into learning that side more?
I just learned by failing constantly. My entire 4 years of film school was a nightmare, creatively a nightmare. It was really fun because I met a lot of fun people and we drank a lot of beers and all that. But the creatively, I just kept failing. I thought I couldn't direct actors. I kept overthinking it and telling them too much information all the time. No, what you're really feeling, nah. You know, I was just like blabbering on, and it was so. The films that I made were so like constructed and probably pretentious, and you know, and so I really made a bad final film, which I really felt like, oh shit, you don't have the talent that you thought you have. So that when I finally got the shot and I made King's Game, I was so conscious of trying to make everything real, like if I don't believe in what I'm seeing, what the actors are doing, if they're not like. If it's not fast paced, if it doesn't feel true, I have to ask them to do it again and again and again and again. So I became really a control freak, and that paid off because the realness of the acting is always what gets you through,
yeah.
like any good film, right? Mm-hmm. If it feels real and true, so I kind of learned by failing, I would say.
Do you think a lot of it is? I mean, I feel like a lot of it is if you cast right. And right. you've explained the characters in enough detail and right. the script is good enough. You shouldn't have to give hundreds of notes to to any actor.
No.
And when you are having to give or feel like you're having to give hundreds yeah. of notes, it's because someone's not on the right page or someone hasn't been cast
exactly.
that has the depth to understand what you're saying. Does that feel true?
That's completely true. I had several instances. Several instances of that on my first film where I cast a very well-known actor in the lead of the bad guy, the antagonist politician, and he's so charming in real life. He's also a magician. He's like a cabaret. He
kept
does
disappearing.
A lot of different things. And so, yeah, no. But what it is was he would play this politician really sort of charming and fun. And after 1 week of shooting, I had to sort of, and I was afraid because he's a big star and I'm a new director. I had to go and tell him, you're doing this completely wrong. Like the politicians are actually not very good. Like when there's a camera, I don't know if you noticed this, but all politicians are weirdly sort of like, no, I think...
They go
like,
stiff.
Yeah,
they're
stiff typical. And weird. And I think you have to be stiff and weird and awkward. Yeah. And thank God that he loved that note. He said, oh, I completely get it. And then he did that. But I got a little braver in what I could tell the actors, I think, because I so badly did not want to fail. So it's just like, just go for broke. Just tell them if you don't think it's working. So I started a thing where I just said, you're overacting. You know, instead of like being afraid, and so now I just do that if I feel it's way too much. Tone it down, dude. Like, and a lot of actors actually like it because it's just you telling them the truth. You're just telling them what you see, and they like that you have a vision. And you say, no, take 70% off. You're like way over the top, and they actually enjoy that instead of somebody like, you know, imagine you're in a bus and like all these kind of
and
weird,
there's a bomb.
Weird way to direct, you know, like
try to
remember your mother.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, exactly.
No, just
you
tell me
these
what you're
five bits right. of this like one, you know, 2 minute scene, and they're like give you five or seven notes of like little micro tweaks,
right?
And they're like, okay, I'm gonna try and do this bit, right. I'm gonna try and do that bit, and then you're just watching like a parrot.
It doesn't work at all. Exactly. Yeah.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars, because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
The Dine Under menu is here for a limited time at Outback Steakhouse. Get an 18-ounce bone-in ribeye and our signature blend of 17 spices, Kingsland pasta, or juicy sirloin and lobster mac, starting at just $16.99. That's better than the actual Outback, where even if you caught dinner, you know deep down you couldn't do what needs to be done. Run free, little buddy. Run free. The Dine Under menu. It's better than the actual Outback. Starting at $16.99 for a limited time at Outback Steakhouse. Outback. No rules, just right.
Okay, so bringing it back to the promised land in that sense. So Zoetrope picked it up with you. You're writing it. Is there any point after they get the script that you've written that they could still say no? Or if Mads said no and they didn't get the cast? Or was it always, we're making this regardless?
Maddening.
Be madness not to.
It does happen. It happened a lot when I lived in Los Angeles for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And that was all that happened in Los Angeles. For those 5 years, all that happened was projects that were really happening. And we got Chris Evans and we got some, you know. And that's my entire life for those 5 years was projects that I'd worked on for a year or more that didn't happen. Suddenly, for some reason, I was like, what the hell is happening in this town? Like, nothing gets made. It's crazy. Yeah. Nothing gets made. And everybody's so fickle and everybody changes their mind. And you know, but in Denmark it doesn't happen that much. I mean, of course, there would have probably, we could have run into a financing issues because it's a quite an expensive film for a Danish film. I think it's about eight or nine, you know, something like million,
right?
Okay. Pounds,
and it's normally half that.
It's normally half that.
Right. Yeah.
So, but Mass's presence
worth every penny,
right? And and because he really gets a film financed, and we were able to sell it to the world. Even before we shot, which means that we had sort of the money to make it. And that's all Mass. That's certainly not me. That's just Mass Mix, right? So that's very good that he came on board.
Right. So now you're definitely making it and you're moving forward.
Right.
You're thinking about your directing process slightly when you're writing it. I imagine in some way you're going, right, okay, I'm already in that place. Was there any changes from what you first imagined the film was going to be to when you then got to a Heath and found a Heath that would work and the image you had of it? Was there anything that derailed you a little bit as a director?
I think that happens on every movie. I had a discussion with one of my friends who's not in the film business a couple of months ago, and she said, oh my God, I hate, you know, this, yesterday I came to work and everything was just chaos and nobody had done what they were supposed to do and I had to navigate. And I hate when those days happen. And I go like, that's every day on my job. Like literally every day is getting to set and finding out something's not working. Mm-hmm. You know, oh God, you know, it's raining or what? Somebody forgot the crane, you know, like, or some actor overslept.
Yes.
Or, you know, it's always some crazy thing that you have to troubleshoot.
Forgot the cauldron of boiling water.
Right, exactly. It's everything, you know. It's always something. And where's the goat? There's supposed to be a goat. We gotta go get a goat. It's like it takes an hour to get a goat.
Goat run away.
What are we gonna do? Like we're gonna shoot around the goat and like weird shit that you have to deal with.
Yes.
It's always
so
the goat.
Always compromise. Every day is a compromise from your original vision. When you write, and I know you guys know this, when you write something, you have a masterpiece in your head and every scene is beautiful and wonderful. And then when you get to the set, it's like, I guess it doesn't look exactly like it was, but you know, I'll try to make it kind of work and maybe we'll fix it in post, you know, there's a windmill, we'll take it out.
Yeah.
You know? So there's a lot of that, but the good thing is experience brings the calm to realize that, well, if it's in the script, if you don't sort of completely mess it up, you'll get something in the editing room. If the script is strong and good, and you don't have to have every scene be wonderful and amazing, as long as certain scenes are, as long as the final sort of like journey is sort of what's in the script, you can probably make it out okay, right? So that's what experience gets you.
Was there any sort of major changes that you maybe had to do pickups or that you altered the edit after you shot it that kind of changed into the final version?
I did. There was one major change, which is the character of the priest. He was quite a lot bigger in the original script.
He was a great actor.
He's a good actor.
He definitely has a presence for sure.
He does. And we found out that we didn't need all these, like in the end. There's like a director's, not really a director's cut, there's like
there's a longer version.
A year from now there'll come a longer version on Danish national TV, and those scenes will be reinstated.
Great.
He actually meets the priestess like a friendship before the it's different. But it doesn't really affect the main story.
No, it doesn't.
So it's not like it's a huge change. And we did one day of pickups, which was only because there were certain times where I felt like when I was in the editing, I could see that, I can see on this day we were rushing so much to get just like the sunshine or the whatever, like the goat, you know, that I forgot.
Joke about the goat.
That I forgot to do
a
close up.
Goat's a real problem,
you know? The goats were always a problem. But, you know, I might have forgotten to do a close up of getting that one beat of emotion. So I asked Mass to come back in for literally one day of certain close ups, which was very easy to do. And I always do this. Every film, you always do like one day of something, right?
I like the ability to come back to it in the edit.
Right. Right.
And you know, as long as you've shot the wides and the establishers and the main sort of core stuff, it's actually so easy to cheat a couple of close-ups when you need it.
I always say it should be part of the every original budget.
Yes.
You should just have like 3 days of shooting after the edit has begun.
If you've got 25-day shoot, it's 28 days.
Exactly.
But those ones are later.
You
so
should
it's all
really
budgeted.
Always do that.
Yeah, I agree. And what's your process like on set? Talk us through a normal day. Do you get to set early? Do you sit in the location for a while? Do you storyboard and plan everything?
Storyboard every single shot. And first of all, because I find it makes a final sort of film more to make a big film for a small amount of money, you do have to do that. You do have to plan a lot, because if you don't, you kind of arrive on set and start thinking, how do I shoot this, where do I put the camera, you know, if you don't have the time, because if you have to do so much work in one day that you really have to be prepared. So every day there'll be like a blackboard of all the storyboard images we're doing today. The crew will be totally know what we're doing. The actors will know what we're doing, what angles, what mirror. And you'll prioritize the hard shots, you know, like we'll do the crane here, we'll do the thing. Here's where we do the really tough shoot of this and the goats, back to the goats. And then we'll move in for some of the close. So I storyboard. I'm always there before everybody. Me and the DOP are there very early and sort of feel the morning or feel the day and what's the weather like and what's the, you know, what are we doing today, what's important, what can be left out if we run out of time. I have a very close relationship with my DOP. We work together on every film since I was 25. It's like we have a shorthand, you know, and then rest of the day all I do is just focus on the actors, because my DOP is my general. He's like, he knows exactly what I want. He sets up all the cameras and stuff and the technical stuff, and I can focus on just the actors. And that's what I do.
I think that's the best. Well, it's not the best approach. I can't say that, but it's my favorite approach. Is because you can, if you've got a good DOP that really understands where you're coming from, you can go through so much of it in advance, and you know you can really get stuck into the micromanaging on the day and start like tweaking shots all the time. Which you know some directors are like pure visual, and that's their thing. But I feel like if you've communicated in advance, the actors are the most important thing to be tweaking. And you know, your DOP should be sort of on your page and you know, allow a bit of delegation.
I couldn't agree more.
And your DOP is Rasmus, is that the one? Rasmus, how do you pronounce his surname?
Rasmus Widerbeck.
Widerbeck.
I think today is going to be announced that, so it'll probably be fine to say that he's won the European Film Award cinematography for this film, which is nice.
The Promised Land. That's amazing. Really cool. And in the edit then, talking about that and moving around. What do you like to do there? Do you give the editor time first? Do you come in later? What have you learned from your process? You mentioned earlier how it made you a better director, I suppose, by going through that whole edit process.
Yeah, I'm very much a guy who likes to be in the editing room and try out stuff myself with the editor. I don't really hand it over. I always let the editor have an edit zero, which is basically an assembly of all the scenes. And then I go like, okay, this is nothing like what I want. Let's do it all over again. But at least there's the assembly, and at least that's a way for the editor to get familiar with all the material. Mm-hmm. But I'm always disagreeing with the choices and the takes and, you know. And so we go through it, and I usually go over in the edit. I spend a lot of time. I think that's because I'm also a writer. So I keep thinking of, oh, maybe this scene could actually be something completely different than what I originally envisioned. Mm-hmm. And then we rewrite the scene, and then we re-edit some of the, you know. And so I tend to go over and probably a little more than I should in the editing room. Okay. On this one, it was particularly hard because it's a film that takes place over the course of, you know, 10 years, I guess. Mm-hmm. And that's a tough to edit without, and you can easily lose the flow, or like people go, oh, I don't want, you know, what happens now and holds next year or something new, you know. You have to keep sort of like being trimming and being very sharp, and so it took a long time to get the final structure.
And you have to find an editor that understands acting in the way that you do as well.
Sure.
Because otherwise it's a very frustrating process, because they're just choosing takes. You're like, why have you chosen that one?
Yeah.
They're obviously not great, or they're looking around. And,
right.
And some editors are like very technical. Some have a great balance. Yeah. Some are like very actory, but they can't sometimes solve like very simple technical things. We're like, well, if you just flip this shot around, you'll solve the problem.
Right.
That's so important, isn't it? Do you tend to work with the same editors, or...?
I've always worked with the same editor, who's Mikkel Nielsen, who actually won the Oscar for Sound of Metal 2 years ago.
Yeah,
great film.
Yeah,
and he and I worked on my first four films, five films. He also did Banshees of Inisherin.
Inisherin,
But so when he won the Oscar, he got so many offers that he had sort of overbooked himself, so he couldn't do this one.
Oh.
And I was like, fuck, man, we've done six films, five films together. But then I got the guy who edits Joachim Trier's film, like The Worst Person in the World. Mm-hmm. You know, and he was a fresh sort of like, it was interesting to work with somebody new. It was really cool. Yeah. And I think you can even feel it in this film. I don't know if you've seen Royal Affair. Some people certainly will have, of your listeners. It's a very different kind of film.
Yeah.
This is much more... It's a little more visceral.
Grounded,
it's more like,
dirty.
Yeah, it's like, and I think that's partly him. He has like zero tolerance for like too like emotional stuff. It's like, no, cut it out. And I was like, you got the point. You know, it's like, it's fun to have like, so he was a pretty strong voice in the editing room, I would say, which
that's
is fun.
Nice. Well, it's interesting you say that, because I thought this film was so rich in color.
Yeah.
And that could have been the grade that you put on it and the style. But
that's all Rasmus, man. He's so good.
It was
so
beautiful.
Good.
Yeah. I literally was going, oh,
and it's all natural light,
it was,
right?
Really? Because it was natural. And dirty, and I was in there in the dirt, and you can feel the fingernails literally putting the potatoes in. But yet the colours were so rich and fresh, and the frost and the sunlight. It was gorgeous.
Radiance of the goat.
Yeah, even the goat looked gorgeous.
Yeah.
So that must be, like saying, when you find those collaborators, you stick with them, right? Or you try to.
Right. Yeah. But we also did something new on this one, which was we looked at the old David Lean movies the way they use the lenses and the way they use the light for depth of field. So on this one, more so than in any other film, it was very wide angle. Like, it was we had such strong depth of field and a lot of focus. So when you, even in the close-ups, you can see
everything in
details
back.
In the background, which is very David Lean and actually kind of old school way to do films. But we found that old school way brought a certain weird modern kind of like cool feeling, where it's like you always feel the landscape and the nature, even if you're sort of in close-ups, which is really fun.
The vastness of it.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Because it does just always feel like you're in the middle of like nowhere.
Right, right. So that was interesting. We kind of had to go back in time to get that look.
Yes, and it was beautiful. And The Promised Land is just such a great film. It's out now. Go watch this film in cinemas. Go see it on the biggest screen. Go see this in cinemas. It's mind-blowing for you. It's an incredible movie. Yeah. Go watch it. It's also April 15th is the date for when it'll be on streaming, so you've got plenty of time. So for now,
See in the cinema first.
We'll promote it again later, but for now, cinemas, go watch it.
Yes, and just to wrap things up, if you had any advice for a younger version of yourself, going back in time, breaking into the industry, maybe making that first feature film or something like that, what would that advice be?
Oh, God.
Don't do it.
I have 5,000 things to say to a younger version of myself. I would say the best advice I can give to any filmmaker that wants to go and make a film or direct a film is like learn how to write a good script, because that always gives you the power to be able to make a direct. If you can't write, then you're too dependent on like, oh, does somebody have a good script? Can you write something for me? Mm-hmm. Just if you can write a good script, you can it's easier to get people to fund your stuff.
Yeah.
Right.
And if you can write interesting characters and not just bland sort of conflict.
Yeah. Strong dialogue. Yeah.
They'll trust you to also be a solid director.
Brilliant.
We're very happy with that.
Just tell the actors that they're overacting. That's fine. Yeah.
allow extra time in the schedule for ghosts.
Always.
Never work with wolves, by the way.
Not in the goats at the same time.
No, don't work with wolves.
They're not trained, they certainly don't want to be. There was a
wolf dog that was trained, but it still took like 5 hours to just get them to do like this, and it was horrible.
A growler.
Yeah.
Well, there we go. Don't ever work with wolves. And write your own stuff. Nikolai, thank you so much. This has been so insightful and fantastic.
Thanks for having me.
Great film, pretty good drama.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
Here we go.